Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
In 1994, the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office enters a property in Loxahatchee, Florida, and finds a chilling sight. Hundreds of exotic birds, including parrots and macaws, are dead or dying inside their enclosures. While they work frantically to save the remaining birds, their focus shifts to how they got in this state. Where is their caretaker, 36-year-old Lila Wadi Burratten, and her 31-year-old nephew, Moses Lal? Did they abandon the birds, or did something more sinister happen? This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, the other night I saw you at one of our book clubs.
One of the many book clubs we attend.
We are attending way too many book clubs. And I mentioned to you that we would be talking about the bird trade, and then you started mentioning that, like, you are aware of a lot of illegal trade of other.
Well, there's, like, a lot of, like, so, like, my daughter has sometimes some weird pets.
Mm-hmm.
Not weird to everybody, but, like, so we have a lizard. And at one point, she was interested in giant African snails, which are illegal here, but people still somehow, like, get them into the country. But it is illegal to import them, and it is also illegal to own them.
Yeah.
And then there's, like, a lot of varieties of insects that are illegal to own as well, but they still make it into the country.
Okay.
Huh. Is that kind of, like, what kind of bird thing we're talking about today?
Well, we are going to get into the bird trade. It's very integral to what we're talking about today, and I actually had to cut back so much from my notes so that, like, I don't go off on this, like, endless tangent about the bird trade.
About the bird trade.
I mean, I read, like, a guy's, like, entire PhD dissertation on the bird trade from Guyana, and...
Well, some of it's interesting because not only, like, some of these things, like, so whenever, like, my daughter mentions one of these to me, I'm like, but we don't need those things. So I feel like the bird is a similar thing. Are they bringing in, like, illegal birds or bringing them in illegally?
So we're going to be talking about specifically...
Or are we actually bringing them in legally? Is this a legal importation of birds?
So I believe it's legal. There's some thoughts about illegalness. So that's kind of where we're going today with this one.
Yeah. Because I just feel like with some of it, it's like, well, maybe we don't, like, if it was an illegal bird, maybe we don't need that kind. Like, there are kinds available. Like, do you desperately need, like, a certain bug?
Well, so this is specifically, a lot of exotic birds have been limited. Anyway,
yeah.
Let's just get into this.
I mean, we do talk about, like, disappearance of women.
Right.
Not so much birds.
Not so much birds, which is why when I told my husband everything I knew about the bird trade out of Guyana, he was like, maybe you don't need all of that in there. And I was like, okay, fair. Okay.
But there's one thing our listeners are probably learning is we love a side story.
Right.
It's like...
It was a side quest. I mean, yeah. I mean, I read the entirety of Dr. Andrew Crater's, it looks like his PhD thesis on the status, management, and trade of parrots in the Cooperative Republic of Guyana.
See? But... I think sometimes there's a reason we love these side stories, because it's like a little break from
everything.
Tragedy.
Yes. Okay. So let's begin. So we're talking about a case of a missing woman from Florida, Lila Wadi Burratten, who seemed to go by the name Lila, and that's how she's reported most everywhere, so I'm going to use that as her name. She was 36 years old and from Guyana, which, to situate everyone who might not be great at geography, this is in the northern part of South America. And Lila has now been missing since 1994. The most important thing you need to know about Lila's family is they were deeply embedded in the exotic animal export business in Guyana. They particularly focused on the export of birds to places like the United States, where they would then be sold into pet stores for the pet market. I really became fascinated with this topic of bird exporting when I first read the poem we're featuring at the end of this episode that was written in honor of Lila, but in diving back in for this episode, I got to expand on this a bit more. And we're going to explore this to understand a bit about what's going on that leads Moses Lal, who is Lila's nephew, and Lila to make some of the decisions they do before they disappeared.
The decisions they're making have to do with the bird?
Yes.
Business? Okay.
Yeah. So the bird business is very intimately connected to this whole story.
Okay.
Which is why I'm going to speak a little bit about the bird industry. One, because I read so much about it. But two, I think it really helps to really give context.
Okay.
Now, I can't speak for Guyana in a contemporary sense. So this is pulling data from the 70s through 90s. So again, shout out to Dr. Andrew W. Crater, whose entire thing I read. And it was an enormous help in establishing this history. So in the 1990s, Guyana was one of the few places in South America where the export of what we consider exotic animals was still happening. This included birds like macaws and parrots and parakeets, along with other types of birds like toucans, as well as reptiles, frogs, caimans, and primates. The bird trade, primarily of the parrot variety, formed the largest part of this trade. And there's a limited market for these kinds of birds in Guyana itself. So the vast majority, about 90% of the birds, are exported. And this was a largely unregulated industry until about the 1970s when licensing happened. By 1998, there were only 22 people in Guyana who were licensed to export parrots. And in Guyana, they developed a division called the Wildlife Services Division, which was part of the Ministry of Agriculture. And their job was to set standards for everything from levels of care, processes, licensing. They also collected taxes and duties on these exports. Despite the taxes and duties involved, the export of parrots was financially worthwhile for exporters. But you don't just have exporters who are making money. The exporters need to have product, in this case, parrots, to sell. So there are trappers who collect the birds in the wild, middlemen who mediate between the trappers and the exporters, and then the exporters themselves. And so all of the people in the system make a living from this export business. And like most businesses, the more product you have that you can sell, the more money you can make. So in the 1970s, when the oversight of this industry really began in Guyana, surveys of the various types of parrot populations indicated that the population of birds in the wild was actually quite healthy and that there weren't any population issues as a result of this export business. By the 1980s, though, the early 1980s, this changed and people became concerned that they could actually be over-harvested.
Are we still experiencing like an over-harvesting of those now or?
Well, some changes happened, right? Because what happens in the 1980s is they're like, hey, we are taking way too many birds, right? And there's a population issue. So in 1987, they actually issue a moratorium on the export of birds. They're like, we're putting a pause on this trade. And that's when they start enacting quotas. So for every type of parrot, of which I now know there are many various different types of parrots, there's like a certain number that can be exported each year. And some of them have zero quotas, meaning like you cannot export that bird at all. And so then the trade starts back up, but then a moratorium happens again between 1993 and 1995. So that's a time frame I want you to remember for
later. Right. And what year did you say again that Lila disappears?
1994.
Okay. So right in that time frame.
In the moratorium, right?
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to insert Lila and Moses' family who make a living from this industry. So Moses's mom is Lila's sister.
Moses's mom is Lila's sister. So, okay, so Moses is her nephew. Yes. So that we already talked about that. Mm-hmm. Did we? Okay, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so again, they're exporters, so they're the ones who are shipping the birds out of the country. Now, after the birds reach the exporter in Guyana, they are held in a facility, and this is one, because they needed to be quarantined to assure the health of the birds, and two, after the implementation of quotas, they could be held back if a quota on that type of bird was already met.
What would they do in that case? Would they release the birds back into the wild?
No. So from reading this guy's research,
yeah,
he said one of the problems is that people who were conducting illegal activities very much like did not want to talk to him about it. I get the sense that for some exporters, it was like you would hold the bird until the following year.
So you're keeping your birds.
You would warehouse somewhere them, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And some of the birds
probably don't make it, right?
Are they well cared for? They are supposed to be cared for because, like,
it's actually profits.
Profit, right? Yeah. But some of the birds end up getting, like, smuggled out into Suriname.
Right.
And just shipped out of a different country.
Like the snails.
Right. So you've got kind of...
Right, because it wouldn't seem profitable to try to house them and care for them for a year and then... At that point, what are you making?
Well, so your profit would then be diminishing.
It would be
diminishing. You'd have to subtract, like,
greatly care. Diminished. Yeah.
Yeah. So after shipping these birds to the United States, you know, the reason they're shipped to the United States is because it's actually quite lucrative to send to the United States. So they were worth about 11 times the amount in the United States as opposed to, like, a local sale in Guyana. So definitely you want to be shipping those out, right? So Lila and Moses's family had business connections in the United States. And once the birds were shipped to the United States, they would undergo a quarantine here in the U.S.
Okay.
So that's why Moses's mother, who again is Lila's sister, asks Moses and Lila to open up a quarantine center in the United States. So I'm assuming that's because instead of outsourcing this and losing money, you could keep that money within the family. I get the sense that Moses was really not thrilled about this. I'm not sure when they opened up the business in the U.S., but Moses would have to have been in his early 20s. So he's pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
And he had spoken to his mom about how he really wanted to be a musician. And she had been like, no, we're in the bird business.
Okay, so Moses is kind of like being forced into this life in the U.S., probably leaving his friends behind, his fellow musicians, any idea of like a career there.
Well, I think he had been living in Canada. Like I don't think he really wanted to be in the bird business.
Wait, he was in Canada?
So I think he was in Canada before.
Oh, they weren't in Guyana before?
The whole family is in Guyana, but I think
Canada. Miss that somewhere?
I didn't say it.
No. Oh, you didn't say it. Okay, that's why... Okay, so he had been, so Lila was in Guyana, Moses was in Canada.
So they're being sent to the U.S. to open up this business.
Right? Okay.
So Lila and Moses open this facility in Queens and name it Malabar. Now, from what I can tell, Moses handled most of the financial and business issues associated with Malabar, and Lila was in charge of taking care of the birds. Because the one thing that literally everyone says about Lila is how much she loved the birds and caring for them. But despite all the advantages of being in New York City, Moses and Lila decide to move to Florida, taking the business with them. Lila liked the idea of giving the birds more space and having a better climate for them. They start renting a place in Broward County in 1987. And though they're on 2 acres, and this is more in the country than, say, Queens, they do have neighbors who are less than thrilled to have Moses, Lila, and the birds next door.
Because of the birds, or?
Yeah.
Are we?
I think it can go both ways.
Yeah.
But the complaints come in really quickly about the birds, right? So their neighbor says their birds squawk from dawn to dusk. You can hear them with the windows shut and the air conditioner on. He also complains about the smell. And it's no wonder, like, the birds are being kept in the living room, the front porch, in a screened area in the pool area, in a former guest house. But there's also 20 cages outside and about 9 wooden shacks in the back.
Do we know how many birds they're keeping? It sounds like a lot.
It's hundreds.
Okay, so there could actually be a smell.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt that this is, like, pretty loud.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because birds can be stinky.
Birds can be. Yeah, it's like, you know, maintaining that level of birds. So finally, this comes to a head in 1992. Lila had been spoken to by authorities, and then she says about the birds, "It's just a private collection. He," meaning Moses, "runs a quarantine station in New York. He keeps a few birds back from each trip for himself. It's his hobby." And she makes it very clear that these birds are not part of the business.
That's not the truth, though, is it? Like, why would she say something?
Well, okay. Yeah, this is interesting.
Yeah, because, like, I don't think anybody, would you believe that anybody has a collection that large?
Of like hundreds of
birds. Of their own birds.
So yeah. Basically, to become licensed to breed or sell birds in Florida, the person just needs to fill out some paperwork and pay a $25 fee. This was at the time, which doesn't seem like a lot of hassle, right? On the other hand, licensing did mean that that person would have to abide by the state's exotic wildlife regulations. That included things like keeping the birds in sanitary conditions, like humane conditions, but it also meant keeping track of sales and transactions. So, to be honest, I'm not sure how much oversight the state would have actually have had over Lila and Moses if they'd been licensed, because there were, at the time, only 9 exotic wildlife inspectors working for the commission and over 10,000 animal breeders, pet shops, and exhibitors with exotic animal licenses in the state. So they're spread pretty thin, so I doubt it would be like an intense.
So there's only nine of these inspectors?
Yeah.
And over 10,000? I hope it's not still like that.
I don't know the numbers now. I'm sure.
Because that seems like there is a lot of room for illegal stuff, but also for like animal abuse situations.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. And definitely at the time, the inspectors were like, hey, we are overtaxed and we definitely need more funding for this.
It's fair for them to say that.
Yeah. So one of the easiest ways to sidestep all of this would be just to simply claim these animals are pets, which is what Lila is doing here. So if you say they're pets, then they don't fall under those regulations and that kind of oversight.
There must be like I know there's a limit to like say the number of cats you're supposed to have in households. Is there not a limit to the number of birds you can have as a pet in Florida?
Right. Well, they're actually in Broward County. There was. So each household could have a maximum of 24. So as soon as she says, oh, they're pets, this opens them up to the other issue, which is they are over the number for pets, right? And then they're told, hey, you know, if you don't comply and get rid of the birds, bring your limit down to 24 or less, you're going to be fined $250 a day.
Yeah, that $25 paper was easier than this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Lila said their plans were to move rather than to give up the birds. She said, the collection is just going to get larger. We don't want to bother the neighbors. We know we have to move. Now, the neighbor, he didn't buy this. He says, you know, they've been promising that for 2 years, but they have not done it. But this time they actually follow through and move to Loxahatchee, Florida. This is likely that they picked Loxahatchee for the fact that there were other people in the bird industry already established in the area. It's more rural, so there's some advantages to moving there. So they start renting a property from Luis and Rita Morales in December 1992. They're paying about $1,700 a month for this property. And the Moraleses initially stay in the guest house for about 3 months before moving out fully. At this point, two things were happening. One, there's Guyana itself issuing a moratorium on parrot exports from 1993 to 1995, which means they were not going to expect large shipments of birds like they had been getting. The second is that in 1992, the United States enacted the Wild Bird Conservation Act, which in short says that it requires that all trade in wild birds involving the United States is biologically sustainable and to the benefit of the species, and limits or prohibits the imports of exotic birds when it's not beneficial to the species.
So the United States, though, is making those decisions even for other countries?
Well, so the United States is making that decision.
Are they, working with them? Or?
Well, no. So the United States is saying, hey, no more, we're not going to let birds come into the United States if that's detrimental to species as a whole. So
okay.
It doesn't affect just Guyana, it affects all the other countries that were importing birds. Guyana is hit more so because they're actually one of the few places still exporting birds, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So at this point, like even when Guyana changes its moratorium, the United States has said no.
So there's two things getting in our way now.
Right. So this essentially will tank their business, which is why Lila and Moses switched to bird breeding. Moses also wants to expand the business outside of the birds and hones in on the importation of turtles and tortoises from Africa. And so he's traveling pretty often, going to Africa particularly, and shipping back turtles and tortoises to their place in Florida. There, he meets a man named Felix, who is the brother of one of his contacts. And Felix travels back with Moses to Florida in 1993. Felix begins helping out around the property. Also helping is a man named Harry, who is a family friend from Guyana. So it's Moses and Lila running the business and these two other men who are helping out around. Now, things are not going smoothly in Loxahatchee. Moses has been talking to his mom and she said that he seemed worried about money and tired. Also, apparently, Harry expressed his romantic interest towards Lila and she rejects him, and police end up responding to the property for a call after Harry attempts suicide after this rejection takes place. At another point, Moses has $40,000 stolen from the property. Now, I guess the exotic animal trade is a mostly cash industry, which honestly makes me suspicious of a lot of things. But Moses was known to keep large amounts of money in the house, particularly before he was going to travel and to find animals to import into the United States. So he would amass some money before his trips. Now, Moses suspected Harry mostly because Harry took off from New York City. And so Moses goes to New York City and confronts him there about where this missing $40,000 is. Harry confessed, but begged to be taken back, which Moses agreed to do. And Lila had some misgivings about this, but...
Well, Harry hasn't already conducted himself very well around Lila.
No.
Like on multiple levels.
She's not down with this situation.
Yeah, she shouldn't be.
There also seems to be some tension between Moses and Lila surrounding the fact that Lila becomes attached to the birds and doesn't want to sell them. Even though he loved birds and did let a macaw sleep in his bedroom, Moses definitely saw them more as part of the business. And there are some reports that he'd been basically liquidating his assets, meaning the birds, by selling off a bunch of them at a time.
I feel like I'd be like the bird person who doesn't want to sell them.
Right. I mean, she's literally like hand raising baby birds. Like,
well, and they're breeding them at this point, too. So they're actually her babies in a sense.
Like, it's going through the whole like incubation. Like, there are incubators. She's hand feeding, hand raising.
So. And now you have to trust some stranger to take care of your baby bird.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All of this brings us to 1994. On May 29th. A bird dealer met with Moses at the Loxahatchee property to discuss the sale of some birds. And on June 1st, this man calls Moses to complete the sale, but Moses delayed him, saying that he planned to travel to Africa in the next few days and wouldn't be able to do it then. That same day, Lila was in the vet's office with a blue and gold macaw she had hand-raised and had named Lila's baby.
Oh, so they were her babies.
They were 100%, right? Later, June 3rd, Moses also spoke to his mother, who was back in Guyana, and told her about his upcoming trip to Africa as well. A few days later, on June 4th, Lila and Moses were at their vet's office again, and that's when Moses mentioned to the veterinary staff that he planned to leave for Africa in a few days. So Moses was not keeping secret that he was planning this trip, but rather conveying it to those he was interacting with. So he's talking about taking this trip. And to be clear, those who were associated with him were also aware that he would often have large amounts of cash on him when he traveled.
Okay. So, and the only person really in charge is going to be Lila when he leaves, right?
Yeah. So
he's going around pretty much advertising that he's going to be away.
Yes.
There's cash in the house and one woman taking care of that.
Well, so presumably he's
going to take... The other guys are there too, but they're not as...
Yeah.
I mean, one already stole from her.
Right. So when Moses travels, he takes the money with him. But
okay.
On the other hand, the birds are a huge asset, right?
Yeah.
So you still have a lot of money sitting in the backyard, right?
He has like a huge amount on him, but he also had a huge amount probably. Like that was a huge amount from his huge amount.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. That's what I'm guessing.
Like, where's the money?
Where's the money?
Okay. So 5 days later, on June 9th, Daryl Crew, who's an employee at Bird Haven, which is a feed and supply store, he arrives at the Loxahatchee property to deliver seed. And this is no small order. It's somewhere around 1,500 pounds of seed that was set up on a weekly delivery. But when Daryl arrives, there's a problem. The front gate is closed and locked, which is unusual because they're expecting this order. When Nolan lets him in, he jumps the fence and he walks the property calling for Lila, but she doesn't answer. Now, this is extremely unusual. Lila was not known to leave her birds. Even the seed guy knew this. So he calls his boss, and his boss said, hey, just leave the seed outside by the gate, because he knew that Lila would need it. She'd often get down to the last of the seed between deliveries, so he didn't want to leave her without.
We'll be back in a moment.
What's clear from here is that rumors in the aviary community begin immediately, specifically because Lila wasn't there to receive this order. Now, to be clear, this concern is primarily about the birds. It's not that Lila and Moses were necessarily unliked or unwelcome. It's that they really didn't have a lot of community connections in this area yet. So the focus is on the birds first here. On the one hand, that's because they're living creatures, and on the other, they're worth collectively roughly $500,000. So the other bird people are talking amongst themselves, and finally someone decides to call Fish and Game. But if you remember, Lila and Moses are not registered as breeders with the state, so essentially they say, hey, this isn't our problem. So those who are concerned are calling the sheriff, they're calling animal control, and they're just getting bumped around with everyone, like, either brushing it off or saying, like, this isn't our issue. On Wednesday, June 15th, Daryl comes back with another food delivery. But when he gets there, he encounters a chilling sight, and that's that all the seed he'd left there 6 days before is still outside by the gate. This should have been taken in and used at this point. So again, he hops the fence and he heads into the property trying to see, like, what's going on.
This is not going to be good, is it?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So what he encounters is dead birds. Mm-hmm. It's estimated that there are roughly 700 birds on the property, and about half of them are dead. Outside where they have cages, there are alive birds with dead birds on the bottom, and many of the living birds are surviving by cannibalizing the dead.
Okay. So you said, like, the Fish and Game, they're not concerned because there's no, like, they're not registered.
Right.
Was there somebody else that they should have called that would, like, just animal control or something?
So they called animal control. They called all of those places.
Yeah, they called all of them. But why did nobody investigate this? And in the meantime, has anyone notified, like, Lila's family that she's not there?
So no, that has not happened yet.
So animal control doesn't care.
The sheriff's doesn't care.
Nobody's been notified about Lila.
No.
We're just, I want to say winging it, but that sounds like a pun because of the bird thing.
Right. But. Yeah, so basically we've experienced this before where basically other agencies are just basically, like, punting it to, like, the next person. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it's not our job.
But in the meanwhile, like, we still have a woman missing and now, like, a huge amount of dead birds.
Well, so they don't know that yet. They just...
Well, this guy does now.
So
now what happens?
Okay, so now what happens is he's like, this is... horrifying.
Right.
He calls the sheriff. The sheriff comes out this time. It's the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office. And the first concern is immediately about the birds. So quite quickly, there are community birders, experts in the field, and veterinarians on the property trying to assess the condition of the birds and get them hydrated and fed as quickly as possible. One of their neighbors is a man named Howard, who also happened to be in the bird business, and he's one of the volunteers that arrived that day. He said he knew something was wrong. He would later say that Lila would go on vacation and come back early because she was worried about the birds. I think something grim has happened over there.
Finally, somebody notices she's missing and that something's not good with her.
Right. So, you know, they're looking around at the property, and investigators can tell even before they get inside the home that something is wrong. One of the lieutenants said, you could just smell the odor of death coming from inside the home. And indeed, inside, they find another startling sight. It's clear that whatever energies Lila and Moses had went into the business, because the house itself is basically unfurnished. Instead, they found rows of aquariums with wood shavings that held baby birds, like a little bird nursery of sorts, and all of those birds had also perished.
We know that Lila would not have, like,
yeah,
let this happen, so.
Now, one of the volunteers, and this hasn't been said much anywhere else, but putting it in here, he claims that the quality of the food the birds that was receiving under Lila's care was substandard. I'm not a bird expert, so I can't say. But he also said that he found several dead birds wrapped in towels and in small sealed boxes and a toolbox. His suspicion is that these birds had been smuggled into the country because this is a method often used, which is to like drug the birds so that their metabolism slows and then ship them that way or place them into other goods so that they can be smuggled in without notice.
So these are unopened boxes of these potentially drugged and smuggled birds.
Yes. So this is incredibly risky to the birds in the best of circumstances. Many die this way. On the other hand, apparently it's only or was only a $500 fine if someone was caught doing it. So I'm assuming if you were smuggling birds, like risk outweighs, you know, or the reward. Outweighs the risk. So, yeah. So it's possible there was something like this happening, but I guess I'm not sure since this is not substantiated by other sources. In total, 335 birds, which includes Amazon, black-headed kites, hyacinth macaws, blue and gold and green macaws. They're all taken. They're alive. They're going to the county to receive medical care and support. They also bring in some dogs, cats, and two squirrels from the property. Meanwhile, there is finally this lingering question, where are Lila and Moses?
So we don't know where Moses is either. Is he not just on a trip to Africa?
Well, so that's the question, right? Like, where are the people who are supposed to be taking care of these birds? And now your initial assumption has been like something bad has happened to them because we're viewing that from a different perspective. But at the time, they're like, these two have abandoned their birds. They've run off, right?
Well, and I just felt like Moses was setting Lila up to like be, you know, to have some sort of break in or something for the money because he's like, I'm leaving.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Okay. So while doing an initial sweep of the property, investigators do spot what looks like a grave on the property behind one of the aviaries. Unfortunately, they don't have the right warrant to dig this up, so they have to obtain one. Meanwhile, one of the investigators named Westcott calls Moses' mother, Mahadai, in Guyana. She says that she's been worried about Moses since the last time they spoke. The two were quite close and he called her on a regular basis. She knew he planned to travel to Africa, but he usually called her on his travels as well and he hadn't. She'd been calling the house over and over since they last spoke, but couldn't reach anyone. Now, she insists immediately that something is terribly wrong, knowing her sister would never have left the birds and that her son would never have been out of contact. She also knew that there should have been two employees, Felix and Harry, on the property, but neither of them were there. Finally, on June 17th, 2 days after the birds were found, the sheriff's office was allowed back on the property to dig up the shallow grave. I think they believed they would find Lila there specifically, but strangely, the site was marked with a vase which was holding a dead flower. Now, I know that if people watch the episode Disappeared about this disappearance, they say that they found dead birds inside
and
that they dug up.
You're going to tell us it's not dead birds.
No. So the reports from the time were that this was specifically a 30-pound dog, which honestly makes more sense.
So it was a dog. It was not.
Not Lila.
A bunch of birds. No, and definitely not Lila.
Yeah. Yeah, I watched the episode and I was like, wait a minute.
But I mean, right now at this point, like, yeah, Felix and Harry aren't even there. We don't know where Moses is. We don't know where Lila is. Are they all together?
Everyone's gone from this property.
Right. And now we just found the
dead dog. Right. So inside there's this like 30-pound dead dog inside a plastic box.
Also the squirrels, that was like a plot twist right there. I want to know more about them.
Oh, I think they were keeping them as pets, not just like wild squirrels. Right. Okay. So then everything is kind of a dead end. A month after this search and subsequent searches by the sheriff's office, like the sheriff's office makes a statement that says, we looked, we found nothing, we went home, we're pretty much done everything we can do out there right now. But on June 20th, another oddity in this case arises, and I don't have an answer for this one, which is that a few miles away, 100 dead African gray parrots are found in a field. And around their legs are tags indicating that they came from Malabar, the name of Moses and Lila's company. And no one is sure how they got there or why they're there.
That is very weird.
In other developments, now that she knows something is wrong, Lila's sister, Moses' mother, flies from Guyana to Florida to speak with investigators. And she is a force. For one, she's still trying to wrap her head around the fact that she couldn't get through on the phone. So she asked Westcott, the investigator, to check the phone lines to the house. And when he did, he found that they had been cut.
It's getting weirder. Mm-hmm. Phone lines are cut. There's 100 dead birds elsewhere. Like,
they're squirrels.
The squirrels as pets.
Yeah, right. So also on June 20th, though, Moses's mother is allowed to tour the property, and she immediately notices that one of Moses's vehicles is missing. It's a 1992 Plymouth Voyager with New York plates. Now, this vehicle isn't one Westcott was aware of, so he puts out a notice to be on the lookout for this van, and it takes a few weeks, but he finally gets a response from Richmond Hills, Georgia. They say that on June 9th, so this is a few days after Moses' mom last spoke with him, on June 9th at 10 p.m., they encountered Moses Lall pulled off of Interstate 95 in Richmond Hills, Georgia, with a flat tire. So again, several days after he was last seen in Florida. Inside the vehicle were 10 parrots and 100 turtles.
You didn't tell me they had turtles too?
Well, remember he was shipping turtles back.
Oh.
Yeah.
I did not remember that. He was shipping turtles back?
From Africa.
Mm. Okay. Oh, yes. I remember that now. Okay. So one of the questions I have at this point too is, okay, so So on June 9th, they say they saw his car. What date was he supposed to be leaving to Africa?
I'm not sure which date he said he was supposed to be leaving for Africa, but that's where everyone has assumed he is.
Right.
But instead, they get this, he was pulled over in Georgia, right?
Yeah, because I mean, it seems like he should already have been in Africa at that point.
Right. So they notice this man who's got a flat tire. They basically ask to see his license. Now, I've got some, like, feelings about this because why are you running someone's license when they just have a flat tire? But that is what they do. And they ran it, and they notice that it is a New York license that is suspended.
I think they ran it probably because of the 10 parrots and the 100 turtles.
Like, what are you doing with?
What are you doing?
So they take him into custody, photograph him, and take his fingerprints. Now, he said he didn't have money to pay for his bond, so the police in Richmond Hills actually wake up the local judge and have him reduce the bond to $318, making sure that he wouldn't have to spend the night in jail. They also made sure that that figure left him with enough money to pay for a night at a hotel, and then they drove him to the closest Ramada Inn for the night.
Are they usually that accommodating?
Apparently. Right. So, okay. He never checks in. He never returns to get his van. Moses was set to have a hearing on July 11th, but he never showed up. Now, this is shocking, and it pretty much confirms what a lot of people seem to be thinking, which is that Moses has done something shady, right? So on July 19th, Westcott, having gotten the information from Richmond Hills, shows the photograph of Moses taken in Richmond Hills to Moses's mom. And she's like, "That's not my son."
That's not even Moses?
No.
Who is this guy? Is it Harry or Felix?
It's Harry. One of the missing workers.
Has she met Harry or Felix?
Yes. Before?
So she's like, "That's Harry."
She's like, "That is
not my kid. Oh my God. Yeah. So Moses is still missing?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the fingerprints also confirm this is not Moses. And I'm just going to point out here that clearly the police could not tell the difference between these two men, despite them looking nothing alike. They're not even the same height. Not long after that, they locate Felix in New York City. Now, that neighbor, Howard, who was also in the bird business, he says Felix had called him and offered to sell him a bunch of Lila's birds at one-third the market value. When pressed about this, Felix says to Howard that he believes that Moses Lall has been killed.
Okay, so Harry was the one in the car. Felix is, like,
trying to sell
off the birds, making a side business with Lila and Moses's birds, and he's thinking that Moses has been killed.
Right.
By who?
Well, so when investigators get in touch with Felix, he conveys that he, Felix, was in Queens on business on June 4th when he got a call from Harry saying that Harry had gone out to the farm and had witnessed Moses and Lila being led away at gunpoint by two white males in a white passenger van. He did not call police and neither did Felix.
We should call the police.
Right. But, so this is one of the theories that people had, that Moses, owing money to people for his business, is abducted and maybe killed along with Lila. But Moses' mother says that if Moses needed money, he could simply ask her and she would have come up with it. Also, as Howard pointed out numerous times, the birds on the property that were left to die were incredibly valuable as a whole, like $500,000 mm-hmm. worth of birds. On the other hand, that means that if someone did harm these two, they would actually have to be aware of that value, right? Like, you'd have to
know. None of this makes sense.
No.
So, will it?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so Felix eventually ends up in prison for the sale of pancake tortoises and after return to Africa. And honestly, from there, this case goes quiet for many years. It's covered on Disappeared and Unsolved Mysteries, but really there isn't much publicity about this or case updates. We know from the Disappeared show in 2000 that in 2001, this case for the disappearance of Lila and Moses was reopened, and it's believed by many at the time that Harry is the key to learning what happened. Unfortunately, he's been impossible to get a hold of. In 2011, an informant claimed that Harry had bragged about killing Moses and Lila and that generally people weren't willing to talk because they were afraid of him. They eventually located him in Jersey City, New Jersey, but when they went to assess his workplace, someone must have tipped him off because they missed him by 4 minutes and he never returned. They think he might be using the name Roy Smith and maybe around the Philadelphia area. Now, you might be wondering why I'm using his name here, because it does not fit into our standards right. of practice.
I was actually going to ask that.
Yeah.
Like, why are we using his name then, and why are we talking about his alias?
Yeah. So it's actually not been confirmed that he was involved. And also, Harry is actually listed as a missing person as well.
So, like, when they missed him by 4 minutes, that was the last anyone's actually seen of him?
So it's like Harry is a missing person, Moses is a missing person, and Delilah is a missing person as well.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Now, like I said, most of the interest in this case has actually surrounded the birds, and I'm sure our listeners have questions about that as well. And to review, 335 birds survived. And so though she was desperate for news of her son and her sister, Mahadai gets involved in a legal battle for the birds. They are held by the county, and the county claimed that it was taking $10 per bird per day to care for them, which means about $3,500 per day. If she wanted the birds, Mahadai would have to pay back the county for the accrued costs. But with each day that passed, that bill was growing higher and higher. And she said $10 per bird per day far exceeded the cost the U.S. Department of Agriculture charged for the care of the birds, which at the time was $2.75 per day per bird. So even when they were in quarantine.
But also, we won't release them to you till you pay this amount. So instead, we'll just keep paying $3,500 a day to take care of them.
Right.
Uh-huh. Like, da-da.
Yeah. So she was arguing, hey, the birds need to be moved to a facility with costs that were in line with this amount. Right. Now, I am with her. I question these costs as well, because one of the publicity things about this case was that local businesses and grocery stores and things were donating food and supplies for the birds. And also veterinarians were donating time.
I was about to say, there's usually volunteers in these situations that help with the care as well.
Yeah. So,
and I don't even know if it would cost $10 a day per bird anyway. Like,
right. Yeah.
I don't even think, like, a cat or dog costs $10 per day to maintain.
Yeah, it was sort of an interesting situation. Now, bird lovers were also pushing back and saying, you know, the family shouldn't get the birds because so many of them had been found dead. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I just think that this is treating like this is a case of neglect. And it was like a horrible way to treat this family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is no indication that Lila particularly would have abandoned
Right. If you're abducted, you obviously cannot care for your pets.
Exactly.
At that point. Like, right. Yeah.
Like, my dog is very well cared for, but if I went missing and nobody else was in my house, like,
he wouldn't get cared for. And yeah. It would not be on you at exactly. that point, because you are also probably not being cared for.
Right. Now, along with this, though, they said that Mahadai, she needed to prove that she was an officer of Malabar, which this I actually get. So technically, the company that owns the birds is Malabar, and she was not able to provide paperwork saying that she was an officer of this company. And so the county didn't want to release the birds, because if they released the birds to the wrong person and that person didn't have legal claim on the birds, they could get in trouble.
That's right? A better reason to not that release the reason. Birds.
Yeah. So they had to post a public notice about the seizure of the birds and ask for Moses or Lila to claim them. Again, this delayed the issue, meaning the bill kept growing more and more. Also, Moses had left behind a $28,000 bill for import fees that he had never paid to the USDA. So the birds were not an expense that Mahadai was able to enter into, and her energy needed to be focused on finding her family. She said, "Nothing will be right until I know what happened to my son and my sister. That is what will always matter most." Eventually, in September 1994, the birds were auctioned off by the county to pet families.
Which is a good compromise on the birds themselves. But yeah, where's her son and sister?
Exactly.
That's the big question.
Right. Like, I think that people got so focused on the fate of the birds, I think, because it was so startling to see that many exotic birds, you know, that had died.
Do you think that ended up taking away from, like, actually locating these two people?
I think so, because so most of the press following June and July focuses on the birds, the fate of the birds, and what's happening to them. Moses and Lila are mentioned in the articles, but it is, like, so briefly. It's, like, explaining why the birds are there, rather than them individually.
So strange, isn't it? Like you can just abduct two humans as long as there's some other distraction.
Right.
Because we talked about this, like, at 9/11 as yep. well. We've talked about it at other points where something else gets in the way of us really understanding that this person is missing and needs right. help.
There's, like, there's these missing people. Now, there are so many unanswered questions mm-hmm. about this case, and really, like, they need Harry to come forward or to be brought in for questioning, likely Felix as well, because there's just so many unanswered questions about what was going on this property in the days before this happened. But what we do know is that whatever happened, Lila would not have left her birds and would not have let them suffer. One of the workers at the vet's office Lila used said, "These people did not abandon their birds. They've been clients here for 9 years. They're the kind of people who would drive an hour to get here with a bird if they think it might have lost a little weight." And her landlord said, "She would never have left her birds alone. She loved her birds." Ornithology. Lilawati Barada, 35, missing since June 4th, 1994, from Lacahatchie, Florida. Hyacinth Macaw. They carve nests into the flesh of trees, widen cavities to make way for thick feathered bodies. Sometimes they lay 2 eggs, but only the first to hatch lives. But this is the way of survival, insurance against the darkness. To capture a hyacinth macaw, cut down the tree it lives in, and when that hard-won nesting ground falls to the forest floor, grab hold and hope to escape the curved beak and mark of its scaled tongue. These are the birds she collects inside cages, the damp heat of the wetlands welcoming them home. Hawk-headed parrot. It is said parrots learn to speak out of love, but they don't know the language of the human heart. In the high rooms of London, Casanova taught his parrot how to call his former lover a whore, another word for his misplaced affection. He forgot the birds know how to bring the curse of bad luck, because the parrots with heads shaped like hawks do not love. In the forest, they are caught with fishing line and nets,
On boats, they are submerged in water to ensure silence. The time needed to survive, calculated at each border crossing. At the aviary, most are dead. Parasitic infection and heat. The starving space of wingspans. Jardine's parrot. Through the strider of song, the molt of feathers, the bird's founder. Fall into each other, keels collapsing, floating bone into bone. There, valleys of down clutch, beaks against chests. Beneath the weight of their moldering bodies, tiny nests still cradle eggs whose inside harden in the choleric sun. The fledglings yet to develop, egg teeth suffocate. Inside a toolbox, two small Jardine's parrots, wrapped in fabric, their orange irises frozen. This is how the dead and living are transported, bodies unnoticed. During that long summer, strands of her hair, blown by Everglade winds, tuck against the aviaries, just out of reach, tiny, desperate beaks. For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.